to the KTEP Book Club on Perspectives. I'm your host, Louis Sines. Joining us on Perspectives, the first half today is Walt Brinker. Walt is a West Point graduate, a Vietnam War veteran, retired Army Infantry Lieutenant Colonel, has provided well over 2,000 free of charge roadside assists as a hobby. And his hobby has been featured in local magazine articles, two newspapers, the Houston Chronicle and the Fayetteville Observer, which runs his monthly vignettes describing actual assists and how readers can avoid such situations. So why are we talking about this? Well, because Walt has written a book and it's called Roadside Survival. Walt, thank you very much for being with us here.
Thank you, Louis. Good to have you.
Thank you very much for serving our country and for serving in the Vietnam War.
Well, thank you.
And coming from the military as an officer, West Point graduate, and then you decided to write a book on roadside survival. How did that come about?
It came about as a result of a hobby I developed. I kind of stumbled into it. Back in 1980, I remember it was Christmas season, and I saw a lady with a hood up on her car, and I pulled over, and she said her engine had died, and she needed a jump start. So I gave her a jump start with some cables I had in the car. And two things struck me after that. The first was how relieved she was at having been put back on the road again. And the second thing was how good it made me feel. And so I began to start looking for cars that were broken down so I could do it again. It felt so good to have helped her. And I just kind of kept on going and kept on going. And I, over time, acquired skills and hardware, mostly all through trial and error, to enable me to do things to help a variety of people.
Now, Walter, it's very honorable what you're doing, and I know that there are some people who still do that once in a while, but we have become so private, and the fact that so many things going on in the world, you can't even offer someone a ride if you see them stranded because they may not trust you. Has that been difficult for you?
I don't give rides to people. I figure that there's more risk in that. I don't pick up people off the side of the road, but I figure I can pretty well count on someone if they're broken down. They're there for a good reason and a legitimate reason. And so I'm willing to take the chance to help them. And I've developed a good eye for what's safe and what's not safe based on whether it's safe from oncoming traffic or safe from the person I might or persons I might end up meeting along the road. But I've developed an eye for it, so I'm pretty confident that I will not get in trouble.
We're visiting with Walt Brinker. He is the author of the book Roadside Survival. And in this book, you describe two kinds of drivers, Walt. Can you explain to our audience what you mean?
There's many ways to slice this, but one way to look at it is there's two kinds of drivers, those who have already experienced a disabled vehicle and those who will. And it's almost a given that you're going to have a breakdown in the future.
Now, when people are having breakdowns, and you mentioned that, you know, you will have a breakdown, and then some people who have had. So despite that, some people do not carry jumper cables in their car, have never changed a tire. And I realized, too, that I remember, you know, the jacks that my dad taught us how to change tires with are no longer the same jacks they use now. Remember,
right.
Put them under the bumper, and I thought those were a lot easier to use than these. But tell us about, let's say, for example, and I'm not trying to be sexist here or anything like that, but somebody who has a daughter going to college or even a young son and perhaps they have some kind of road trouble, what are some of the things that you would encourage parents to do?
Well, I would encourage parents to take their children out. They're about to become drivers or about to leave home, and do several things to make sure that they understand how to take care of the most fundamental problems they're going to have. And three-quarters of the people I come in contact with on the road have tire-related issues. They've had a flat tire, they've had a blowout, the tread has come off, and then they have to contend with other problems which come from that, like the lug nuts are on too tight, they don't have a jack that fits right, the jack is broken, they don't know where to put the jack on the car to lift it up. There's a whole bunch of things like that. And then three-quarters of them are tire-related. The other 25% are a combination of being out of gas, having your engine cut off due to probably an electrical shortfall someplace, or the car overheats, or they lock themselves out of their car. Those are the common reasons I find people broken down. And I'm not a mechanic. You don't need a mechanic. I say 95% of the time people break down, you don't need a mechanic. But you do need to have, if you're going to bail yourself out, you need to have a few smarts to diagnose what the problem was and some basic tools to bail yourself out. No matter how smart you are, without certain basic tools, you're not going to be able to help yourself.
So coming from you being a former officer and even a doctor, any professional, they do what they call the process of elimination, and that's what you're telling people to try and do, figure out what is not wrong or go down a list, etc.? We are visiting with Walt Brinker. Walt is the author of the book Roadside Survival. And Walt, as we mentioned about not having jumper cables, etc., you have one of your chapters at the very beginning of the book. It says it's Walt's top 10 roadside survival tips. Do you mind going over those top 10 tips with us, please?
Sure. The real meat to support all this stuff is in chapters of the book, which I wrote, but this is one of the chapters, and it summarizes, and I boil it down into the top 10 ways, top 10 tips to get along on the highway. One is to you prevent tire failures by having your tires inspected by a professional every 5,000 miles, and then that involves going to a tire store. Hopefully you bought your tires there, and you have a relationship with them. You go in and have them check your tires for uneven wear, for having damages on them, like cuts on the sidewall or nails or something in the tread. Second thing is you prevent failures on the highway, blowouts on the highway, by making sure that your tire pressure, especially before long trips, is appropriate. And you must use a tire gauge for this. A lot of folks I know just go up and say they bump the tire with their fist and say, yeah, it looks good to me, or they look at it and say, yeah, that's cool. But the fact is you need the tire pressure gauge to get a good reading on it. Don't drive around without a serviceable spare tire. I find a lot of folks don't have a spare tire, and they should. Or the spare tire is low. 80% of people I have stop for with tire issues, I find that the spare tire is either too low to use or flat. 80%.
Wow, that's pretty high.
That's a huge flag right there. Don't drive around without a jack and tire changing tools, which actually work on your vehicle. A lot of times I found folks have swapped out tools with other cars, and the ones they've got with them don't work. A fundamental thing which most folks don't think about is that the car is going to break down when you least expect it. Now, the flat tire is going to occur where you least expect it and where you least want it. For example, on a shoulder that's got a lot of dirt and stuff, or even in slush or snow. So I advocate bringing an old beach towel along with you to lay down on the ground to prevent yourself from getting dirty. You can change a tire in a suit almost and rarely get dirty if you know what you're doing. The bottom line is you got to lie down on the ground to change a tire to get the jack in place. Also, work gloves. Have a pair of gloves in the car with you so that when you handle a blowout tire, which has a lot of steel bands exposed after the blowout, you don't slice your hands to ribbons. Also, another tip, fundamental tip, is practice before the flat tire occurs, removing the tire from stowage on the car and mounting it on the vehicle using its jack and the tire changing tools that you have on board. Make sure that the nuts on the car, on the wheel, are not too tight. If they are, there's ways you can overcome that, which we can talk about in a few minutes. Make sure the jack works okay. Make sure you know where the lift points are. If you don't have the correct lift points, you can damage the car's body. If some folks have a locking lug nut or locking wheel lug nut, you need to make sure you can find the key to that thing. Otherwise, you're out of luck. After you change a flat tire, the priority ought to shift immediately to replacing the tire that went flat. Even while, as you drive down on your spare tire, your first stop needs to be a tire store someplace where you can replace that tire that went flat, because now you haven't got a flat. I mean, you don't have a spare. A lot of folks tow trailers. I find that trailers are a special potential problem area. A lot of folks don't mind the tires on their trailers, and the trailer will be parked for a long time, so you don't have much tire wear, and folks figure, well, I don't have any wear on this tread, so I'll just drive it. Well, that's a mistake many times, because 6 years is the age of a tire before your chances of a blowout really do increase quite a bit. A lot of folks also have a trailer that's got that requires a jack for it that does not work on the car, or vice versa. So you need to have if the car's jack doesn't work on the trailer, you need to have another jack for the trailer. And the lug nut sizes are probably different as well for the trailer wheels and for the car's wheels. You need to be sure all that's covered. Then we've noticed that most points address tires, because tires are the most frequent problem. Mm-hmm. The next key point is battery connections. The connections between to the posts on your battery, if they're loose, you're betting that your car is going to break down. And so just a simple thing of tightening up those nuts to hold the battery clamp on tightly. And then have a set of long jumper cables in the car. I advocate 20 feet or longer, because that way you can run the cables over the top of a car if you can't get nose to nose or side by side. And know how to use them to jump start an engine and also to charge a dead battery in another car, or get a charge on your battery from another car. Have a cell phone and a 12-volt battery charger in your car. Then if you get in trouble and can't fix it yourself, you can call for help. Have a road atlas with you just in case you're far from home and your GPS doesn't work right, or the GPS somehow doesn't tell you where you are. But one of the most fundamental things is listen to your vehicle. It'll talk to you. And you need to listen. It'll talk to you, and it'll do things like if it pulls to the left or pulls to the right, that means there's probably going to be a tire that's low on air because there's more friction when there's low on air, when the tire's low on air, so it'll tend to pull to that side. If you have a weak engine start, that means you probably have a weak battery or have a weak connection to the battery cables, to the posts of the battery. If you have white steam come out of the back of your car when you start it, that means you probably have a leak in your block, engine block, and you're getting coolant, like water or antifreeze, going into your engine, and you're getting steam out the tailpipe and not exhaust. You know, if you have a funny smell come out of your car, or notice there's a squeak, or that you pull away from out of your garage and notice there's a pool of liquid in your garage, that's not natural. And so you need to, you know, your car's telling you, I'm about to fail on you. So you need to pay attention and take your car to a shop and get it checked out.
We're visiting with Walt Brinker. Walt is the author of the book Roadside Survival, Low-Tech Solutions to Automobile Breakdowns. And Walt just went over top 10 things to look out for. And he goes into detail of all these things in the various chapters in the book. And as he mentioned, most of the breakdowns are related to tires. When you're traveling or going on a trip, it doesn't matter if you're just going, you know, to work every day. What kind of tools should you carry in your car, Walt?
Well, every car comes with a set of its tools when it's new. And if you have a new car, or you're certain that no one has pilfered any of the tools from your car, you're probably going to have the correct tools with you. However, sometimes those tools are not adequate. For example, a lug wrench. The lug wrench that comes with the car typically has a short handle, maybe 12 inches, 14 inches long. If the nuts are on too tight, as if done by a tire dealer or tire store, for example, or somebody else who may have tightened the lug nuts on your car too tight, the short-handled lug wrench is not going to work. So you need to augment that with what I call a cheater bar, which is nothing more than a 2 feet long, 1 inch in diameter steel pipe that you can slide over that handle of that lug wrench and quadruple the force that you can apply to that lug nut to get it off. The fundamental tools, again, we talked about having an old beach towel so you don't get dirty or when you get on the ground, having a tarp. I've changed tires in slush, the muckiest slush and mud you can ever imagine, and I stayed bone dry because I had a tarp with me, a cheap tarp. It's incredible.
As I mentioned earlier, Walt Brinker is the author of Roadside Survival, and this book has a lot of pictures that are self-explanatory and kind of guide you as far as what to do. But, Walt, do you have a website or do you have YouTube videos also that people can look at to find out more about this?
Oh, yes, a website that I put together called roadsidesurvival.com. There also, I've got a page that has a collection of actual vignettes about actual assists I've done, which point out a lot of the common reasons for breaking down and how you can prevent that in the first place. There's another page that's about the book itself, and it describes it and says where you can buy the book. And there's several links you can go right to, and Amazon.com is one of them. It's sold at Barnes & Noble and several other bookstores.
Well, Walt, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. It's interesting how time has just slipped by so quickly. And again, Walt Brinker is the author of Roadside Survival. You can go to roadsidesurvival.com and find out more about Walt and also about links to his book. And we want to thank you very much for taking the time with us.
Thank you, Louis. Hopefully folks will do that and they can save themselves a lot of grief.
Thank you, Walt.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
We've been visiting with Walt Brinker. He is the author of Roadside Survival. Perspectives will continue right after this.
For once, a golf movie that won't get golf lovers teed off. I'm Bill Newcott, and from AARP Studios, this is Movies for Grownups.
People call me Riverboat. I also happen to know a few fellas with lots of cash who wouldn't mind losing it.
All I gotta do is play golf?
All you gotta do is play golf.
The young golfer, played by Jeremy Sumpter, falls in with a high-stakes gambler, played by Christopher McDonald, in The Squeeze, a new film written and directed by longtime TV sports director Terry Jastrow. Jastrow also produced The Squeeze along with his wife, Ann Archer, the star who played Michael Douglas' betrayed wife in Fatal Attraction. Ooh, remember that boiled bunny? Well, she says her husband, Terry, who has directed more than 60 live golf telecasts for ABC, wanted to make a golf movie that would seem authentic to real golf enthusiasts.
He always found it disappointing in previous golf movies that it was so apparent that the star golfer, the star of the film, really couldn't play. You would know immediately that he wasn't a pro. That was important to him in this story because you'd never believe that this kid could win all these matches and fool all these people if you couldn't see that he could really play. So he auditioned a lot of guys, and finally when it got down to the last few, he took them out to our club in L.A. and played with them, see if they could really play.
Ann says she's gotten into producing in part because she's discovered, like most women in the movies, there aren't many good roles written for women middle-aged and beyond. Hard to believe, but even today, Hollywood's unique mix of age and sexism continues to vex even some of the industry's most talented women.
Of course, I want to be in front of the camera. If we ever find a project that's right for me that I can do both, I will. But Terry and I make a very good team. I'm a great story editor for him, and we work well together, and we're going to continue to make projects together.
Well, get yourself a good script for you, because we'd love to see you again.
Thank you. I would, too.
The Squeeze, starring Jeremy Sumpter, Christopher McDonald, and our old friend Michael Norrie, is in theaters now. I'm Bill Newcott.
And joining us on the second part of Perspectives today is Susan Axelrod. Susan is the Executive Vice President and Regulatory Operations of FINRA. And Susan, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And if you wouldn't mind telling us again what FINRA is?
Sure. FINRA stands for the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. We are an organization that's dedicated to investor protection and market integrity. That's our mission. We have more than 3,400 employees around the country in most major cities, and we have a large presence in Washington, D.C. and New York. We do examinations of broker-dealers. We bring enforcement cases against firms or individuals as appropriate. We write rules. We do surveillance of the markets for things like insider trading. We are essentially the cop on the beat every day for the individual investor.
Now, what would you tell people who perhaps are not all that familiar with investing? And sometimes, you know, there's a stereotype that people say, well, if you want to invest, you're going to have, you know, hundreds of dollars to invest or thousands of dollars. But if somebody wants to start off investing slow, little by little, and then grow that nest egg, build it up, how would they go about doing that, Susan?
Well, it's a great point. A lot of investors don't have, you know, assets that they can just put away for investing. So starting off small is actually really smart. People should get the recommendation for a broker from a family member or friends who've used someone that they're comfortable with. That's an important thing. But people should understand that investing in markets is really for the long haul. Studies show that people who are in the market long term actually do well. And it's important to know what's happening in the economic environment around us, be sensitive to markets, use a trusted investment professional, and really not be in and out day to day. It takes a lot of time and attention, and you've got to focus on the fees and costs that are associated with having an account, which is something you should ask your firm about if you think about investing.
As we're talking about investing, and as you mentioned, you know, for some people, starting small could be very scary for them because they go, well, you know, this is all I have, and I don't know if I should do this or not. It's all new to me, and they just throw themselves into the water without realizing what to do. And online, a lot of people shopping online for Christmas and the holidays, if somebody sees perhaps a pop-up ad or something that talks about investing online, what do they need to be worried about if they do it online?
Well, the most important thing you need to be worried about is who's the firm and who's the broker that may be soliciting you. So again, you've got to focus on doing your homework on the firm and on the individual. And FINRA actually has a free tool on our website, which is finra.org, FINRA.org. And that tool is called BrokerCheck. And if you go to our website and you click on the box that says BrokerCheck in the top right corner, you can get lots of information about a broker and about a firm, including a history of customer complaints, any disciplinary history, and that's really important when you're thinking about investing your hard-earned money with somebody.
What about investing in precious metals? Would you recommend that? Because people are starting to talk about our economy is not doing so well and things are going down. If you invest in precious metals, particularly gold, it's something to do. It's the future. But then you look at the market and the prices are kind of down right now. It's a bit like in silver. It's not as high as it's ever been.
Look, if you're starting off investing, things like mutual funds are things to consider. There's lots of different things to consider. When you get into things like precious metals, you need to understand more. That's not a basic investment. So with any investment, you need to understand that there's risk. And with any investment where there's risk, you should understand where the risk lies. So do your homework on the investment. Don't just jump in for something that looks like it can make you a quick buck, because those things often fail and often disappoint. Do your homework, understand the risks, understand what, you know, the potential earnings, and understand there's no investment at all that can guarantee you a certain rate of return. Markets go up and they go down. And if you're getting a consistent rate of return, particularly a high one over extended period, that may be a red flag that something may not be right.
Okay, what about if perhaps there is something being offered through your job. There are different programs being offered through your job, and you say, well, I really want to try this. But then perhaps your wife or your husband says, well, you know, we need to watch our budget because we don't have that much windfall for us to invest. So how much should they invest, or how much should they have put away before they even invest?
Well, saving is really important. And even if you can save $10 or $100 a month, that's a good start.
We're visiting with Susan Axelrod, and Susan is the Vice President of Regulatory Operations, and she is with the Office of Fraud Detection and Market Intelligence. As you mentioned, you are like the police of the brokers and people who invest, take care of them. Because of the technology, some people will be able to just make a web page look identical almost to the real thing. And so people who are not familiar with this, they'll look at it and go, oh, well, that looks good. And they go ahead and send their money.
Well, you got to be really careful. You're right. There's a lot of replication of, let's say, requests for information from firms that look legitimate. It's always really important to contact your firm, log onto your account via the secure website, make sure that you are going to the right place and an accurate place and not some fraudulent website that's going to be set up. They can look alike. Always go back to the source, the primary source, your firm, and ask if this is legitimate or not.
As far as the scams go, because a lot of scams come out around this time of year with tax time, taxes are behind us now, but looking to the future, a lot of people tend to be on the prowl, and some of the usually suspected victims are elderly people. Are young people just about the same, but like somebody who's just in college, just getting started out, do people take advantage of them, or is it pretty much the number one scam against older people?
No, I think there's different groups of people that are susceptible. For example, there's a lot of investor alerts that are on our website, again, at finra.org, where you can see some scams that we've recently tried to put investors on notice about. Those can include a company that says, we found the cure for Ebola, so invest in our stock. Many of those are not legitimate, but take advantage of what's going on in our society to basically say, we've got the cure, invest in us. Any investor is susceptible in that regard. Senior investors are susceptible for different reasons, primarily because they're going to make important decisions. They've garnered wealth from working all these years. They're going to make decisions about where to put their retirement money, and different people want to help them do so, and they may be susceptible in that regard. Also, diminished capacity issues, memory loss issues, that make them susceptible. And finally, many seniors live alone. They're vulnerable, they want someone to talk to, and they're looking for someone to trust. And there are people that may prey on seniors as a result of that.
We're visiting with Susan Axelrod. Susan is with FINRA, and she has given us investment tips and also some of the alerts to be aware. And as you mentioned on your page, finra.org, you do have it broken down into the most recent alerts and different annuities and insurance. And I see at the top here, or near the top anyway, is e-cigarette stock scams. Tell us about this.
Sure. Like I mentioned before, knowing what's going on in our environment, there's lots of people that try and pick up on what's the next big thing and how can I sell to people that we found the cure or we have the best e-cig or, you know, and basically what we call pump up their stock. So investors are interested, they buy it. As the price rises, they then want to sell it and dump it. So people have to be on the alert. After Hurricane Sandy in the Northeast, obviously there were people that said, oh, we're a company that's actively involved in the cleanup, buy our stock. And you've got to be focused. And the alerts, as you mentioned on our webpage, note a lot of those. Hurricane Sandy, Ebola, e-cig. It's all people, you know, where we've seen really trying to engage in fraudulent activity. Investors should be on the lookout because obviously, you know, if someone had found the cure for Ebola, that would have been something widely publicized. It would have been focused on by you know, CDC and others. So ask questions. Know what you're investing in. If it's too good to be true, it's often too good to be true.
Susan, tell us about a 529 plan. What is that?
529 can help people put away money to save for education. Again, another important tool for savings. You know, college education is obviously very costly in this day and age. Putting away money for that's important. 529 plans can help you do that.
Now, when you're dealing with people as far as investing and making sure that they know what they're doing or who they're contacting, as you mentioned earlier with the viral disease scams or even the e-cigarette scams, a lot of times to people, you know, when something bad happens, the good in us comes out and we want to help. And sometimes you'll see a lot of scams out there. As you mentioned, the hurricane, the people say, well, you know, we have this opportunity to help all these people relocate or help them in their homes or they've lost this. And so pulling at the heartstrings.
Well, I agree with you. That's a big issue, and particularly because I live in this area after the hurricane, I wanted to help. But the best way for me to help, candidly, was to go physically over and really visit with people who've been displaced or were having issues, try and deliver food to them and just give some support. While geographically not everyone can do that, just investing a stock that says it's going to really help the cleanup of Hurricane Sandy isn't the way either. You know, look for legitimate ways to contribute, charities that we know of, like the Red Cross, where you can send in money and actually know you're going to help people.
Now, sometimes when people do invest, they fill out all the paperwork, they do whatever they have to, but then they just let it sit there. And it's fine because it's long-term investment, as you just mentioned. But should they follow up, and how should they follow up on that? Because sometimes they'll get something in the mail, and perhaps it's a statement of the account, and they don't understand what it says, so they toss it.
Well, really, really important point. You want to focus on the account's activity. When you get information and correspondence from your firm, you should go through it. You should be looking at your account statements for things like money movements to make sure they were authorized, or investments to make sure you both authorize them and you understand what they are. If not, reach out to your broker. If not, if you're not comfortable going to the broker directly, go to the branch manager at the firm. Or if not, go to the compliance department. Or you can always come to FINRA if there's concerns about account activity being violative.
And what about after you invest? As you mentioned there, you have to kind of track your investment. But after you get something and then perhaps you need money to sell some stock, you need to sell some shares, and you don't quite understand the account transfer process or how do you go about selling this? What do people need to know to make sure that they don't get ripped off?
Well, if you're in an account that's commission-based, you will be charged a commission based on the buy and sell activity in the account. So you should understand what that rate of commission is, how it's impacting your account. If, let's say, you bought a stock and then you're selling it, you're making a $300 profit on the transaction, but then the fees seem to be, you know, just as much as that. Well, that's a question. You need to raise it to the firm. You need to understand what those fees are, because that does not necessarily make sense.
As an older couple, if they have annuities and other things, do they need to hold on to those or cash in some of those life insurance policies?
It's really important, depending upon different individual circumstances, not to say there's a one-size-fits-all approach, but understanding different circumstances for people, being leery of, you know, just cashing out, asking the questions about surrender fees or any charges that they may incur. Those are all good, strong practices.
As we're talking about already, you know, preparing for next year's tax situations, some people will say, well, you know, I invested in something at work, and I think they told me they were going to take it out before taxes, or it wasn't taxed, and I really don't understand that. So what do you let people know, or what should they know about their investments to tell the tax man?
Well, I think they should probably get documentation from the firm that shows the activity and give that to someone who's helping them prepare their taxes to see if there's any costs. But again, being on top of your account, asking the right questions, reviewing and keeping the activity and the documentation is really, really important. Again, not a one-size-fits-all approach, but everyone should have different needs, different liquidity needs, different ability to pay fees, et cetera. So these are all helpful tips, and I hope the investors out there are listening. FINRA.org is a great source for investors. So please visit our website if there's additional information that can be helpful.
Well, Susan, we want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. We've been visiting with Susan Axelrod. Susan is Executive Vice President of Regulatory Operations. In this capacity, she basically oversees the enforcement of the Office of Fraud Detection and Market Intelligence and Member Regulation. And as she mentioned earlier, you can go to FINRA.org to find out a little bit more about what she has been talking about. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, DJ Orozco. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.